From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. On the road to perfect equality and understanding between blacks and whites, well, we've crossed a few things off our to-do list. Segregation and slavery are shameful eras of the past. Brilliant black businessmen thrive in the boardrooms of corporate America. And for most of the 90s, the most famous person in the world was Chicago Bulls legend Michael Jordan. All that's a good start. Now, the real work begins, and every single person matters.
I was the most racist, snotty little child until independence. You know, I could be paralyzed and crippled with guilt for that, or I can write an honest book about what it is like to be racist.
Today, the continuing struggle against racial inequality and the quest for understanding. From one woman's fight to overcome the racism of her African childhood to the web's most provocative question and answer site.
I've had a couple of questions come in from black people who insist that white people, as a habit, tend to pick their noses in public much more than a black person would. In fact, that a black person would never do that.
Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. Well, the truth is, words can hurt. And in the pantheon of painful words, one always comes out on top. In his controversial new book, Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word, African-American Harvard Law professor Randall Kennedy says the N-word is still incredibly hard to get a handle on.
This is a word that has, in some instances, had blood dripping from it. This is a word that has changed people's lives. This is a word that really crystallizes the insult, the contempt, the vilification, the oppression that people of color, particularly black people in the United States, have had to deal with throughout American history.
Now, we got a lot of things, a lot of racism going on in the world right now. Who's more racist, black people or white people? Black people. You know why? Because we hate black people, too. Everything white people don't like about black people really don't like about black people. It's like a civil war going on with black people. And there's two sides. It's black people, and there's niggas. And niggas have got to go. Hey, I love black people, but I hate niggas, bro. Oh, I hate niggas. Nah, man. And I see some black people looking at me. Man, why you gotta say that? Why you gotta say that? It ain't us, it's the media. It ain't us, it's the media. The media has distorted our image to make us look bad. Why must you come down on us like that, brother? It ain't us, it's the media, okay? When I go to the money machine tonight, all right? I ain't looking over my back for the media. I'm looking for niggas. So you think I got three guns in my house because the media outside? Mike Wallace, run!
Randall Kennedy told Steve Paulson that he thinks the N-word is hilarious in that Chris Rock sketch. But the hate that's haunted the word is still very much alive today.
I didn't want people to think that this was only something relegated to history. You know, this is something that happened, but wow, we're past that. So one can go onto the internet and encounter sites that are devoted to nigger jokes, jokes like the following. What do you call a nigger boy riding a bike? Thief. Why do niggers wear high-heeled shoes? So their knuckles won't scrape the ground. Why do decent white folk shop at nigger yard sales? To get all their stuff back, of course, and then on and on and on.
So this is not just ancient history we're talking about here.
Absolutely not.
Has the word always had this history, this kind of derogatory history, the insult that we've been talking about?
There were people who used nigger or terms very similar to it in the 1600s, and it appears as though some of them, at least, were using it in a completely neutral way, did not seem to be using it in a derogatory fashion. By the 1800s, nigger had clearly become a derogatory, offensive word. How it became that slur is unclear. Nobody knows for sure.
Now, you chart the way this has been used by many people, including presidents. And there have been some presidents who've used it rather freely. And in one case, Lyndon Johnson, you argue that it may have been okay for him to say nigger. Can you explain that situation?
Well, Lyndon Johnson used nigger throughout his career, and he used it in lots of different ways. But one way in which he used it, I think the one that the episode that you're probably talking about is the episode in which he used it around the time that he was nominating Thurgood Marshall for a seat on the United States Supreme Court. And one of his aides suggested another jurist as a possible candidate, another black judge. And Marshall said to his aide, "When I put a nigger on the Supreme Court, I want everybody to know it's a nigger." Now, Lyndon Johnson was doing that for effect. He was doing it to sort of satirize the traditional use of nigger. He was doing it almost to poke fun at white supremacists who would be appalled at the idea of a black man sitting on the highest court in the land.
Now, there are some people, like Bill Cosby, who say that the word nigger should never, ever be used by anyone, including by blacks.
Right.
What's your take on that?
I think that that is a mistake. I term that view the eradicationist view, and I reject that view for two reasons. One, I think we have to recognize and appreciate that nigger is deeply ingrained in American culture and shows up in many of the classic texts of our culture. So Martin Luther King Jr. in Letter from a Birmingham Jail talks about nigger. Ralph Ellison, Richard Wright, William Faulkner, Mark Twain, they all deploy nigger in their work. Richard Pryor's great comedy album, That Nigger's Crazy. What are we to do? Are we to erase these things, or closer to home? What are we to do about Quentin Tarantino's films, or Chris Rock, or the comedians that used to be on Def Comedy Jam? Are we going to burn those albums or erase those texts? I think not. I don't think that that's the way to go.
One response is that it's okay for black people to use the word. Richard Pryor has every right to use it, but it's not okay for a white filmmaker like Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, and I reject that. I don't think anybody should use the word nigger in a racist fashion, and anybody who does ought to be condemned. But this is a cultural artifact, this particular word. And I think that it's part of our cultural inheritance. In my view, it's available for anybody to use in a way that helps to enlighten us about our condition. So if a white comedian were to satirize the hip-hop culture, or to satirize his fellow comedian Chris Rock, that would be fine by me, so long as he was funny.
You mentioned Chris Rock. He's got a comedy routine that begins, "I love black people, but I hate niggers." What do you make of what he's doing there?
Well, I think it's an extraordinary routine. I think that that particular text is a wonderful text. When you listen to Chris Rock perform, especially before predominantly black audiences, it gets a tremendous response, in part because he's not the first person to say that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, many people have said that. What's interesting about him is he says it out loud. He says it before the public. He says it before mixed audiences.
And where he gets flack is when he's especially playing to white audiences. It's sort of like, oh, you know, this is sort of a way for the white folks out in the audience to get titillated by, you know, being able to sort of bandy around this word.
That's right. Some people say that. And in fact, he's reacted against that a bit himself. There's a tape he has where after he gives his routine, he has a second routine in which a white fan comes up to him afterwards and says, I think you're right, Chris. I think you're right. I love black people too, and I hate niggers. And the next thing you hear is punch, punch, punch. And what I infer from that Chris Rock is saying, listen, I'm privileged to say this, but a white person is not.
Now, there are critics of this word who say that when black comedians or rap artists use nigger, it's really a reflection of their self-loathing, that they've internalized mm-hmm. the racism, and that's why they can't get beyond the word.
Sometimes that's true. It's undoubtedly true that there's some black people who use the word nigger, and when they use it, they are manifesting internalized bias against black people. That's true. But there are also black people who use the word nigger who are thoroughly self-aware, are not consumed either consciously or unconsciously by anti-black bias, who use the word advisedly. They have a strategy for their use of the word. What they are attempting to do is to turn the tables on the historical deployment of this word. They're saying that this word was intended to strike fear in the hearts of black people. It was intended to make black people feel ashamed of themselves. And they're saying, guess what? I don't feel afraid of this word. I don't feel ashamed of myself. And to show you that dramatically, I'm going to use the word, but I'm going to use the word not in a negative way, but in a powerful way.
There have been some interesting legal cases. One of them happened about 10 years ago when a white basketball coach was fired after he used the word nigger in front of his players. Now, he had actually asked his black players, would it be okay? Because apparently he had heard them sort of calling each other nigger in a very positive way, sort of suggested
yes.
toughness. And so he said, is this okay if I use this? They said yes, but he ended up getting fired.
That was a very interesting case. The white basketball coach, it was not an all-black team. There was one white player on the team, four blacks. At halftime, they were losing a game, and he said, I need to talk with you guys. I need to fire you up, and can I talk straight with you, and can I use the N-word with you in the way in which you use the N-word? And they said, yes, sure. And he says, listen, when you've used the N-word, you have said that to play like a nigger means to play with concentration, to play with heart, to play with verve. Well, I need five niggers on the court. And this coach points to the one white starter, and he points to this guy, and he says, so-and-so here is playing like a nigger. And then he points to one of the black players, and he says, so-and-so here is playing like a nigger. He says, the problem, the reason why we're losing is because you other three are not playing like niggers. I need five niggers on the court. Well, they go back on the court, they lose, but that's just the beginning of the coach's problems. The coach is fired. That firing led to two lawsuits. The team sued the university on the grounds that the university's speech code was a violation of the Constitution. A United States district judge agreed with the students and invalidated the university's speech code. The coach also tried to get his job back, but he lost for legal reasons we needn't get into. In my book, I asked the question, was it fair to fire the coach? And my answer to that is no. That this coach was clearly not intending to insult anyone. He was clearly not intending to insult the players. In fact, none of the players felt insulted. He was clearly not intending to insult anyone.
But what happened was when word got out that he had said nigger in this halftime speech, there were protests, student protests at the university, and the white administrator came down on him.
That's right. The officials at the university really came down on him. In part, they were afraid. This did get publicity. And in order to insulate themselves from any allegation that they were being soft on racism, they fired this coach. I think that was excessive. Nigger as a force in American life is something that the legal system has had to grapple with time and time again. This is a word that, for good reason, generates anxiety because it has long been associated with racism in America. It has been used as a weapon against African Americans. And it's a good thing that people are concerned about this term and don't want to give offense to people. That's an advance in the history of our country. But we shouldn't go too far with it in the sense of making it an unmentionable of this word, because I think when you make it unmentionable of this word, or perhaps any word, you actually endow it with more destructive power than it would otherwise have.
Randall Kennedy teaches law at Harvard University. He spoke with Steve Paulson about his new book, Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word.
I'd like to get down with my peoples and my folks, my dogs and my lopes, the room filled with smoke. I got these Crip niggas talking to the Bloods, and niggas ain't spreading slugs, but spreading love is the thing we do since 92. What's the use of you killing me and me killing you? We had the picnic off the liquid.
Coming up, the strange song that rocked the world and galvanized the civil rights movement. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Sometimes it takes a social movement to change the world. And sometimes, all it takes is a song. Amazing Grace changed the world. The Marseillaise changed the world. And so did the revolutionary anti-lynching song Strange Fruit. It's the title of David Margalek's history of the song he calls an early cry for civil rights. He says Billie Holiday sang it for the first time in 1939 at New York's liberal nightclub Café Society.
There was this moment of silence when she was finished, one of these moments which probably lasted only a second or two but seemed much longer, during which she had enough time to wonder whether she'd made a terrible mistake by singing this song, a song unlike any that had ever been sung before, really. And then, finally, one person started to applaud, and the whole house started to applaud, and it was only at that point that she realized that she'd done the right thing by broaching this song and performing it.
You know, I think in a way that's what happens to everybody who listens to her sing it, too. There is this, there's a sense of the beauty, of the perfect pairing of Holiday's voice and the song, and then you begin to realize what it is she's singing, and it's as though you don't know what to do.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, on the one hand, when you realize what the song is about, you don't know for a split second whether applause is even appropriate. You know, you've just witnessed a lynching, and you don't know what the appropriate response is.
Yeah.
And I think that this must have been particularly arresting when she first sang it and before the song was well known. But I can attest from personal experience to the fact that the song still has that effect. It still stops people cold.
Bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves, and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree.
It's powerful stuff, isn't it?
It was powerful as a poem, but once it was set to music, I mean, this was unlike any lyric that had come before it.
You know, it's not something that you would expect to be sung. It isn't, in fact, a poem that you almost need to see on the page so you can keep your distance from it and absorb it. It's a strange thing that it began to be sung.
Well, I think that the fellow who wrote it, Abel Meeropol, must have known that he was on to something. He wrote it under the name Lewis Allen, but Abel Meeropol, who was a school teacher in the Bronx, a social activist, known undoubtedly to many of our listeners here as the person who, with his wife Anne Meeropol, adopted the two Rosenberg children, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg's two sons. But he was a very accomplished songwriter. He had seen a picture of a lynching in a magazine, and this is what moved him to write the song.
Now, that goes against what most of us think. Aren't there some versions of this story out there that say that Strange Fruit was written just for Billie Holiday, or that she was involved in writing it?
Well, this was a story, in fact, that she perpetuated.
And now I'd like to sing a tune. It was written especially for me. It's titled Strange Fruit. I do hope you like it.
I mean, she talked about either having written the song or having had it written for her. And I think that the story was plausible because she became so associated with the song that people thought it had to have been done for or by her. But in fact, it came to her. It came to her later on after it had been in circulation for a couple of years.
But not everybody thought this song was worth fighting for. I read in your book that a couple of people, including her mother, didn't want her to sing it, thought later on that it ruined her life.
Well, there were many people who thought that. I mean, other people, her producer and the man who discovered her, arguably, John Hammond, was opposed to her singing the song. He thought that it marked a turn in her career and a turn for the worse, that she got very heavy and sort of mournful, and it took the bounce and buoyancy out of her music. Her music was never the same after that, you know. And he seemed to think that when jazz singers, you know, became heavy like that, they lost something.
Well, in fact, that's worth talking about, because while it has never become a standard that a lot of people have sung, other people have recorded it, quite a few by now, but nobody seems to sing it quite the way she did.
She was the only one, almost the only one for many years, who had the guts to sing it, and she put her stamp on it to such a complete degree that many people were really afraid to touch it for a long time.
Pastoral scene of the gallant south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh.
The folk singer Josh White sang it around the time that Billie Holiday did. There's a story in the book, in fact, about Billie coming into his dressing room one night with a knife, brandishing a knife and saying, you know, stop singing my song. So she also discouraged people from singing it. She wasn't happy about other people doing it. But in fact, it wasn't that much of a problem because it was material that was just, first of all, it was so closely linked to her. And second, it was dangerous to sing. It was unpopular. People felt very threatened by it, even in friendly environments.
Well, it was also the kind of thing that you sort of had to sing last. I mean, what could you sing after this, too?
Well, that was part of her routine, in fact. Barney Josephson decreed these very elaborate stage directions for her. I mean, this was his idea as much as it was hers. He said that he wanted audiences to get their insides burned out by it, was the phrase that he used. And so it was always the last song that she sang. She never did any encores afterwards. All the lights in the club would go down. All the service would stop. There's even one story I heard about waiters going around and confiscating cigarettes before she would actually start to perform the song. Everything would just come to a complete halt. There'd be one little pinpoint of light shining on her, and when it was over, the lights would go down, and when they came up again, she'd be gone, and that was it.
Well, again, hard for others to do, but in fact, there are a number of others who've sung it. The jazz singer Cassandra Wilson is one of the people you talked to. What was her reaction to Strange Fruit?
I thought her reaction was very interesting and very sensitive. She's someone who comes from the South. She grew up knowing the song, but having a very healthy respect for it, for the song, for the material, and for the singer, for Billie Holiday. And she told me that, in a sense, she knew that she had a rendezvous with this song. She knew that at some point she would sing it but she had to get good and ready to sing it. She felt that she would do it, but only at the right time. And when she did it, she had to put her own stamp on it. She couldn't just imitate Billie Holiday, which was a foolish thing even to attempt. And so she sings, in fact, a very different version of it, a very sort of a darker, smokier, more impressionistic version of it.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging.
There was a recording, I think, of Sidney Bechet playing it without the lyrics, but it's as though you can hear them. While he's
yeah,
playing.
That's right. And even I'm told that even that version was difficult for him to release. You know, that it was difficult to get that song, recorded for him. I mean, the song was that sensitive.
How important was Strange Fruit, do you think? Did it change anything? Did it contribute to social change? Did it make people think differently about what was happening in the world?
I think its effect grew over time. It sold well, but it was kind of a cult song. I mean, it wasn't something on the Lucky Strike hit parade, but it was the kind of song that left an indelible mark on people who heard it, particularly young people who heard it. I think that it, in a sense, awaken the social consciousness in many, many people who heard it when they were young, who sang it when they were young, and also when there were still all sorts of taboos. I mean, nowadays, I think it's probably very hard to shock anybody with a song. Almost nothing is beyond the pale. And here you were confronting something that literally wasn't spoken about, and you were doing it, you know, in a medium through music that was bound to call attention to it. And the person who was doing it was a 24-year-old black woman in a nightclub in New York, a 24-year-old woman. The whole thing is really pretty extraordinary.
Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rise, for the tree to drop. Here is a strange and bitter cry.
David Margalek is the author of the book Strange Fruit. If Billie Holiday got the ball rolling for civil rights back in 1939, today, Philip Milano is doing his part to foster understanding between blacks and whites. Just log on to yforum.com and you'll see what's shocking some people and thrilling others. Milano told Ann Strangechamps that he created the Y Forum as a place to ask the kind of questions that might have got you sent to your room when you were a kid, like, why do white people smell like dogs when they come out of the rain? It's the title of Milano's book, and the kind of controversial question some people don't want asked.
I've been compared to everyone from Adolf Hitler to Isaac Newton. I'll get a complaint, you know, that it's way too politically incorrect and sensitive, and then the next email will be, you know, this is too politically correct. You know, I mean, it's like one will say it's incorrect, another will say it's correct, so I guess I must be doing something right. Everyone seems to think that, the way that a certain question is handled on the website is for some sort of an agenda or reason why I've put it up there, but really I've tried to make it a place where people can go and ask these types of embarrassing cross-cultural questions with no cause or agenda behind it. You know, I have no other cause other than to promote conversation. I've even tried to stay away from the word diversity because there's, you know, certain connotations that people will make about that word, oh, this is a liberal project or whatever. But generally, people have been fairly pleased with how it's been handled and are pretty amazed and sometimes shocked at the content and how civilly and patient most people will be with some of the, you know, the craziest questions.
And some of the questions are really bizarre, like the one that's on the title of the book, why do white people smell like wet dogs when they come out of the rain? I mean,
exactly.
We do?
Well, apparently a number of people think so who aren't white. That question was so symbolic of the whole project. And when it came in, it really was a turning point for me because it made me sort of stop and think, you know, am I really going to go through with this? Because it was just so out there and it was so, and you know, bizarre, I guess, is in the eye of the beholder because most white people I've talked with have never heard of that. But most black people have.
So it was a real question.
And I really winced when I put it up on the site because it was just so, I guess the bluntness of it, you know, kind of hit me full force. But I did put it up and I went into work and talked to some black coworkers of mine and they were like, yeah, Phil, that's something that we talk about.
So what did people say on the website? What did people write in response?
Well, you know, I've never gotten the quote, you know, correct answer to that question because, you know, the whole goal of the project isn't necessarily to get the right answer up there. It's to show what the level of the conversation is on these issues. So, you know, some people try to explain it in terms of, you know, we have certain oils in our hair as white people that maybe black people don't have as much of. I talked to an expert in odors who said that it had more to do with, you know, your own nose becoming acclimated to, you know, the people around you that you are around most of the time, but, you know, noticing other aromas, you know, more profoundly when you're around them and you haven't been around those people.
You mentioned questions that are sort of like urban legends. There's one, why do black people usually seem to back into their parking spots? That's another one. I mean, I guess I never noticed that.
You know, the site is designed to handle those types of questions, questions that have to do with more human behavior and such rather than the larger issues of the day. So I really try to stay away from questions about let's debate welfare or let's debate affirmative action because, quite frankly, and this is kind of heinous as saying this as a person in the news media, but I really don't think those issues are as important as these smaller questions.
Really? Why?
Because I feel that these smaller questions about human behavior have been so neglected, and they're the ones that I think we need to get beyond before we can start talking about the larger issues. You know, if I'm sitting across from you at the table and I'm wondering, having all these myths about the way that you talk or the inflection of your voice or the way that you smell or the way that you wear your hair, I think it colors the whole conversation. But you know, we're so nervous about talking about this stuff in the mainstream media or even between each other that we sort of supply the answers to ourselves rather than even bother to ask the question. So that was my dream. My goal was to kind of get this conversation going. Even in the mainstream media, I mean, you saw what happened when Clinton held his town halls on race. They were pretty tame.
There's one you write about that came, I think, early on in the project that was, maybe it was the question that kind of began things for you. It was kind of heartbreaking. It's this woman who wrote and asked, what might a typical weekend night be like in a black family?
Yes. And that was one that made me feel that, you know, I'm onto something here because, you know, here was a woman who actually, you know, thought that perhaps there was a typical way that an entire race of people might spend an evening. So yeah, that made me feel that there was quite a gap. And I, you know, I've laughed a lot, but I've also wept at times, just especially at the beginning when so many people were just flooding the site with these questions. And I felt, God, you know, there's still such a gap and people are just so nervous about talking about this stuff. So it's been a roller coaster ride, definitely.
Is there much anger? I mean, do people get angry with the people who ask the questions?
They sure do. I would classify those responses as two different ways. Some of the responses are hateful, and some of them are hostile. A very small percentage are hateful. I would say of 30 or 40,000 postings I've looked at, you know, fewer than 1% are just people who are just flat out, you know, just race baiters or members of white supremacist groups or whatever. It's a very small portion. And then there's maybe, you know, 15 or 20% who I would regard as hostile, which I would regard as a person who's maybe angry, but at least willing and wanting to talk and engage another person, even though they may have some preconceived notions or hostility. You know, and I certainly get people who are angry with the title of the book. I was, you know, processing some questions about that this week. You know, people saying that there's no way you could get away with this title if it were, you know, do black people smell like wet dogs when they come out of the rain? But, you know, you go ahead and do this about white people.
Do questions still come in that surprise you?
Well, I've had a couple of questions come in from black people who insist that that white people, as a habit, tend to blow and pick their noses in public much more than a black person would. In fact, that a black person would never do that, but that white people do it all the time. You know, so it's, you know, they say if something happens twice, it's a trend, you know, so.
Did you put that one up?
Yes, I did. And of course, most white people said, well, gee, that's not true. You're generalizing about an entire group of people, and you just simply can't make that kind of a generalization. And, you know, they're probably correct, because obviously you can't, you know, paint an entire group of people with a broad brush like that. But that doesn't mean that it's not something that's talked about, just as, you know, this wet dogs question is talked about apparently enough that just about every black person knows about it.
Any others?
Well, let's see. I got one recently, this isn't quite as bizarre, but a person wanted to know why a black male can look good in a purple suit and a white person can't.
And what was the answer?
Well, the first answer that came in is, let's just put this rubbish to bed. You know, this isn't true. A white person can certainly look good in a purple suit. But then another black woman followed that up immediately and said, you know, that's not true. It's not nonsense to ask that question. It can very well be that a darker skin tone can carry a color better than a lighter skin tone. And, you know, so don't be so quick to flatten this person just because they asked the question. And that's what I'm always trying to guard against, is I want it to be a site that people feel safe coming to and asking their question, and not the answer being, well, you know, you shouldn't have asked that question, you're ignorant. I want the answers to be, you know, trying to actually address the question.
Philip Milano is an editor for the Florida Times Union in Jacksonville, the founder of whyforum.com, and the author of Why Do White People Smell Like Dogs When They Come Out of the Rain? Just ahead, unlearning the past. One woman's quest to bury her family's racism and understand the Africa she loves. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Alexandra Fuller loves everything about Africa, its smell, its sounds, its people. But it wasn't always that way. Steve Paulson spoke with her about her memoir, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, An African Childhood. Fuller says she grew up in a white family on a farm in what was then called Rhodesia during the Civil War. At the time, she wasn't aware of the hate her parents held for the black Africans around them.
As a child, you can't know what racism is. So the language that they used came into my vocabulary the way, for instance, Inuits are supposed to have 20 different ways of describing snow. My parents must have had 20 different ways to slander black Africans. And they spoke almost as if Africans were not just a different race, but a different species. I think that's very common in a war experience, to dehumanize the enemy to the point that they don't exist as human brothers and sisters. I think you almost need to do that if you're going to point a gun at somebody and pull the trigger. And it was important, I think, for them that my sister and I understood Africans in this way in case we needed to pull a gun on Africans. We were taught, we were handed guns at the age of 6.
So you were very aware of the political violence around you.
I was aware of the violence around me. That it was political didn't occur to me. I was a child. I didn't have any awareness of the politics. In fact, I didn't understand peace. I didn't understand the concept of living in peace. When Mugabe came to power in 1980 and there was independence and the war for liberation was over, another war began between the Shona people, led by Mugabe and his 5th Brigade, against Nkomo's people in Ndebele. And that war went on until 1987, till I was 18. So I had not known peace. That, I think, is one of the big differences between this book and, you know, obviously people have brought up names like Isaac Dennison and Beryl Markham. But they'd written in that rather ridiculous period. I call it the British picnic in Kenya period, you know, where they sort of went out and had cucumber sandwiches and ignored the fact that their gin and tonics and cucumber sandwiches were being had on the backs of an entire continent. I mean, they were oppressing an entire continent to do it. My childhood happened to be through the sort of teapot of that Tea Party cracking.
And it's worth pointing out that for all of the warnings that your parents would give and your teachers at school about, you know, watch out for bombs, watch out for mines, it wasn't just paranoia. You write, for instance, about how a lot of African men would leave their villages and go off and join the guerrilla camps, and you found remnants of those camps on your family's land, which suggests that they were watching you go about your daily affairs.
Oh, all the time. I remember my father dressing up to fight. He fought on the, what I consider the wrong side of the war. He fought to keep Rhodesia white. And he was called up by the Rhodesian government, and the Land Rover would come to the end of the road, and down he would walk. And he had painted himself black, in black stripes. He was in camouflage. And my mother had made a cotton band, camouflage band, go over his watch so that it wouldn't glint in the sun. I remember my father telling me that they weren't allowed to brush their teeth because the smell of that toothpaste was so strong. So, you know, the sense of living really two lives, one secret, hidden, fighting life, and then this other life where you're trying to be normal.
Now, your family also, even though they were quite poor and they were farmers, they did have some hired help, black help.
Well, isn't that the irony? I mean, we would be hungry sometimes, but yes, we had servants.
And how were they treated by your family?
Almost as if they didn't exist. I've described it since then the best way that I can, is that to live in Africa assuming superiority is to live in white noise and not be listening, not paying attention to what's around you. So they were treated very much as tools, I think.
You have a very vivid scene, a horrifying scene, when your parents' cook robs your house, steals your mother's rings, and brutally slashes a woman, and your father and a few friends of his hunt him down. They go out the next morning. And I'm wondering if you could read that passage, because I think it really illustrates some of the racial tensions then.
Dad radios mum from the car. Oscar Papa 28, Oscar Papa 28, this is Oscar Papa 28 mobile. Do you read? Over. Mum runs from her bedroom, but Vanessa and I have heard the agri-alert crackle into life too. Tim, Oscar Papa 28 mobile, this is Oscar Papa 28. Are you all right? Over. There's a pause. And then Dad's voice, hissing with static. I got the bastards. We found your rings. Over and out. Mum shouts, wahoo! And Vanessa and I spontaneously perform our version of a red Indian war dance around the veranda. Wah, 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 wah. We skip on alternate legs. By the time Dad comes back with July and his companion, both the cook and his accomplice have swelling eyes and lips and hard, bone-like lumps on their faces. Vanessa and Mum and I are standing in the yard. When Mum sees July get out of the car, she runs at him. She's screaming, "Kaffir! Murderer!" She starts to beat him, but Dad pulls her back. He says, "Let the boys deal with him." He nods to the boys. The militia, who have come to arrest July and his companion, turn and look the other way. Dad's boys kick July, and in one soft sound, like a sack of mealy meal hitting concrete, he buckles to his knees, and then they kick him again and again. Then Dad says, "That's enough, eh?" But they don't stop. Dad says to the militiamen, "Better pull them off before they kill the bastard." The militiamen break the boys from the tight scrummage of kicking. They put July and his accomplice in the back of their white pickup. He has been handcuffed, and his eyes are almost shut with swelling. As the militia drive off down the road, he makes one last attempt to escape, flinging himself from the moving car and hitting the dirt road. It seems impossible he doesn't burst on impact. Two of the militiamen explode out of the front of the truck, and then dust kicks up, and the white truck and the men and July vanish from view for a moment. When the dust clears, they are dragging July behind the truck by a rope. He runs, his legs spinning like an egg whisk, until he is jerked off his feet, and then he is pulled, twisting behind the vehicle, until it reaches the end of the driveway. After that, the militiamen throw him in the back of the truck, and he does not try to jump out again.
Do you remember what your response was when you heard that story?
I was there when July... when that incident occurred.
You saw that beating.
Yeah. There were two occasions that stand out in my mind when I felt that I was neither white nor black, that I could neither belong to this family nor turn my back on Africa, and when I hated myself for being white and for being a part of this family. This was the one occasion when, young as I was, I felt the sense of self-loathing and the burden of my whiteness without even understanding the true heritage, my true horrible inheritance.
How old were you then?
I must have been about 9 when Violet was attacked. The other occasion was after the war, when my mother, very pregnant with her 5th child, took me out to a squatter camp that had been set up on our farm by refugees coming back from Mozambique. And she was furious that they had set up a squatter camp on the river at the top of our farm. And she felt that the farm was ours. And she had put a lot of work into the farm. My father had been out fighting. She'd run the farm single-handedly for so long. And she rode her horse at these people who had set up the squatter camp. And I was on my horse, sort of cowering under the roof of a hut. And the split that I felt was that I didn't want something to happen to Mum or this baby. I was old enough to know that about miscarriages, and I was old enough to want this baby desperately. We had lost 2 children in our family at that point. But also, I was terrified she was going to hurt the villagers. She was running at women and children with her horse. And I think then I knew that her brilliance and her bravery and the things about her that were wonderful, the flip side of that was this terrible madness. And that was the first time I think I saw that madness. It was as if the last thread to her sanity had snapped, and that murder wasn't out of the question.
You've done something, it seems to me, very unusual with this memoir. I mean, you've really told the story from the wrong side of history, from the racist perspective. How did you approach that as a writer?
I tried to write fictionalized versions of this because it was so hard for me to face up to the truth and face up to, you know, what I have just told you, this great, horrible, ghastly mantle of my heritage.
And you don't sugarcoat it. I mean, you could have softened the way your parents come off. I mean, in many ways, they're very endearing, but not on the question of race.
Right. Well, when I tried to write it as fiction, one's instinct is to sugarcoat. And it was one of those sort of 3 o'clock in the morning things when I sat up in bed and I said to myself, I have to tell the truth. Somebody from the wrong side of the war needs to tell the truth about what it's like growing up within the confines of racism. Now, it's not all black and white. Because my parents were racist, it doesn't mean I loved them any less. And I'm very, very grateful for some of the life lessons they've given me. My mother certainly didn't coddle us. She wasn't a great nurturer, but she was a fantastic teacher. And when I came to the West, I was 18 years old when I left Africa and understandably nervous about launching out into the great world. And she looked at me and she said, "Bobo, there's practically nothing anyone can do to you now to hurt you anymore. Off you go." Well, maybe that was a good thing. And it's true, you know, nothing, I really do feel like almost nothing can happen to me that I can't face.
Do you ever think about moving back to
Absolutely.
Africa?
Absolutely. Daily. In fact, we're moving back probably towards the end of this year to Tanzania. I think that all of us have magnets in our souls, something close to that maybe. And do you know that inexplicable feeling that you have? You haven't met someone before, but you just have this instant attraction, or even have some sort of, might just like them very, very much, but for no good reason. That's your soul magnet for people. And you might love a place for no good reason at all. That's my soul magnet, is for those parts of Africa, Central and Southern Africa. I get off the plane and I open my mouth to drink the air. I don't just breathe it. It's the tastes and smells and sounds of Africa I just long for.
Alexandra Fuller speaking with Steve Paulson about her memoir, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, An African Childhood. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickard, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Charles Monroe Kane, with engineering help from Marv Nunn. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Race and Redemption, number 33A.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Their eyes meet across a crowded room. Her toes curl. His heart pounds. In that instant, they both know they'll love each other forever. Yeah, right. This is real life, not a pretty myth. Or is it? If you've ever been lucky enough to fall in love at first sight, To the Best of Our Knowledge wants to hear your true story. We may share it with the world in our February love show. To find out how, log on to www.ttbook.org.